Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Coco Express, part of the Blog Talk Radio Network. Your host on the Coco Express is Aurelia Lyles. She's all about keeping it real. Great guests, interesting topics, so get on board. Listen, learn, live.
Good evening and welcome to the Coco Express Show for Monday, April 15th, 2013. This has just been a crazy day. I have not been able to tear myself away from the television set watching the aftermath of the bombing at the Boston Marathon. And just the words coming out of my mouth kind of seem foreign and just so odd and out of place. But it's the world we live in. However, you know, before we get into that and go through that, we have an amazing, amazing young man joining us today. And his accomplishments parallel someone who's twice his age. The things that he's done, the opportunities he's provided for others is just completely outstanding. And oftentimes when we talk about our youth, we usually have this negative image that we see. Not in this case. This man is just an example of just what our future can be like. And with people like him in our future, we have an excellent chance of really moving forward in a positive manner. Please allow me the opportunity and the pleasure, as well as the honor, to bring to you Mr. Roy Paul. Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
I am doing well. It's such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is. I am just in awe at just what you've done so far. I mean, I kept looking over things and reading, and I'm just taken back by it all. And I am just so pleased, you know, that you're out there and you're doing it. So before we go into, you know, anything other, let's find out more about you. Give us an idea of what your background is like. Who are you?
I am Roy Paul. I was born and raised in the Bronx for about the first 12 years of my life. And at about 12, we moved to Orange County, New York. I grew up in the Bronx. It was a pretty active community. Because it needed to be. The Bronx at that time, and still is in many respects, was the highest in terms of teen pregnancy and gang violence, you name it. So there were a lot of active people in the community, and that's what I grew up around. And so it was no surprise when I went to Orange County, New York, in Middletown specifically, in a very sort of quiet, laid-back atmosphere that I started to say things like, why aren't more people getting involved? And where is the activism? Where is the community involvement? And it just so happened that I found my niece sitting in class, and one of the teachers said, we are going to give you these tools, and you'll be able to pass the readiness exam. However, this test is not really an example of how good and academically astute you are in class, but you have to take it because it's a state mandate. I kind of turned to some of my fellow classmates and to the teacher, and I said, why are we taking this test if it's not going to really be indicative of how we are academically at our fullest potential? Well, it's just a test. You have to take it to a state mandate. And I realized that people have really gotten accustomed to the status quo. That's sort of our human nature as people, right? Someone says, you have to go and do this, and you have to go and do that. And no one really challenges that. You just sort of go along with the flow. But I said, no, wait a second. Someone has to stand up for this, because if no one says anything, then we'll just keep doing things that don't really prove whether or not we can excel in life or academically. We'll just be doing it just because someone says we can do it. That ain't right. So I just so happened to learn that there was a statewide movement to get rid of the Florida readiness exams that are in New York State, or to challenge them so that there's some teeth in this exam, and it's not just passing people who really shouldn't pass, because what ended up happening is a trickle effect goes down once you go to college and you want to get to graduate school. Those bad scores, those unlearned lessons follow you throughout life. So I started getting involved in it. I had about 200 signatures from fellow students to go to Albany and petition against the system, and continued to get involved in the local education process in my community. And someone said, you know what, there's a seat coming up on the Board of Education. You might want to consider running. And I said, not really. No one, at that time I was an 18-year-old, first year in college. I said, no one's going to elect me to the school board. I mean, you have to be like 75 years old with grandkids and 40-plus years in education. I mean, I said, I'm just not someone that you would think of to run for a school board. I'm just not your typical candidate. But as I started to think about it, I really couldn't think of any reason why I shouldn't be on the Board of Ed. I was a product of the school system. I knew many of the stakeholders. I was involved in the educational process for the past year or so, so I knew what many of the hot button issues were. And I said, if anyone can speak to these issues or at least put a different perspective on it, because had I got elected, I would have been the youngest member by some 40-something years. So I said, you know what, if for nothing else, I will at least feel as if I'm bringing my two cents to the table, whatever that is, whatever experiences I'm bringing, then that is. And I would have been the only African-American on the board at the time. So I said, you know what, in a district that's about 75% minority, I can bring something to the table. And so we started the campaign and enlisted the help of a lot of people, knocked on a lot of doors. People had mistaken me for a member of the Jehovah's Witness and a whole bunch of other stuff. But I kept going, knocking on doors, and people said, I've never had anyone come to my door and campaign for a school board. It was really an educational process. People didn't know what the school board was. Now, many of them had school kids who were going to schools in the community and didn't know what the Board of Education did. That's the kind of education that had to go on in that campaign. And we enlisted the help of a lot of young people. I went to a lot of sports games and parks and different concerts and tried to grab people in who normally would not be involved in the political process. And so we didn't want it to be a big political process. We wanted it to be a movement. We wanted people to feel inspired about their own communities, that they wouldn't necessarily just do this to help me, but to do this to help themselves. And throughout that campaign, some of it was great, some of it was not so great. But in the end, we ended up winning by 36 votes. And I always say we ended up winning because it really wasn't just me. It was a whole team of people that assisted with that campaign for it to be successful. So a couple of days shy after my 19th birthday, I was on the board and I had a 5-year term. And so that's sort of my political background and how I got involved in public service. And for 5 years, it was a great time. It was I learned a lot about education policy, learned a lot about curriculum. I learned a lot about dealing with law firms and budgets. We had a $145 million budget all the time that I left, and I was one of 9 board members to oversee that. So I got a really crash course that most people can go and get their MBA and won't have the kind of experience that I had.
You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, it was an MBA and MPA. It was a master's and non-profit. I mean, it was a whole bunch of different degrees piled up into 1 5-year term. So I had an amazing experience. Some of it was political. You know, not all of it was roses. But you know, throughout that, too, I learned. And it's all shaped me to be the person that I am today at the tender age of 25 going on 26, because I see many of those experiences that I had sort of weaving themselves into what I do. And the perspective that I have on things now has largely been formed because of my time on the Board of Ed, because I can almost 9 times out of 10 look at myself in a current situation and go, you know what, if I put on my school board hat, these are the sort of things that I would have to deal with. This is the way that I think this ought to be to go. And I tell you, the biggest thing that I learned on the Board of Ed is how to trust my instinct and to make a decision. Because when you have to sit back and watch something going on, you know, sort of like putting it in layman's terms for your listeners, if you're a resident of Connecticut and you are in the state legislature, say 2 years ago, you are in the state legislature and someone says, let's try to pass a comprehensive gun bill. And say you're not in favor of a gun bill passing. So you probably would have been a no-vote. Then Sandy Hook happens. And now the entire world is watching you as a member of the state legislature in Connecticut to see if you're going to pass a gun bill. And who can't? But who would say, no, we don't need a gun bill after Sandy Hook? Who has that kind of courage? But it forces you as a member of the state legislature to sit down in Connecticut with all your other colleagues and try to come up with a common sense approach that at the end of the day, you can seem like you can pass sensible legislation. That's the kind of decisions that I had to make on the school board, not gun-related, but issues that really make you think about what your position is. How do you really feel about a topic? And can you make that decision on the spot if someone snapped their fingers? And that is the greatest lesson that I could have ever learned on that Board of Education. And now I am much sharper when it comes to making decisions. I can make them quickly. I can sort of figure out the lay of the land and be very decisive and trust my gut. So I had a great time.
That is just excellent. That's amazing. Now, with working with the school board and working in the communities and working with the different people, what was the most challenging aspect that you encountered?
Well, you know, everyone wanted something different. There were so many different stakeholders. There was the Parent Teachers Association. There were the students. There was the Teachers Association. There were the elected officials citywide. There were the county representatives. Then they had the State Education Department's input. And then you had to deal internally with the other board members. And that was all many times on one decision because everyone had a different opinion on it. And what I found is that on a board of education, if you make one decision that a lot of people don't like, you've upset 50% of your base. Half of the people are going to be happy with you, and half of the people are not going to be happy with you. And the difficulty...
Go ahead, please.
And interrupt me whenever you want to, by the way. I'm very long-winded. the difficulty is that you have to try to make everyone not just happy, but you have to make everyone try to understand why you're making the decision that you're making, even if they disagree, because they're going to disagree. And that was something that someone told me when I got elected. He said, look, no one's going to agree with you 100% of the time. At least try to make them understand. And that is extremely difficult when people are very personal about their experiences and about how they think you should vote. So I would say if I had to pick the major difficulty is trying to deal with several different people from several different walks of life to at least understand why you made a decision, even if they disagree.
Okay. Now, you also had the opportunity to resurrect a local chapter of the NAACP. Now, how did you find out about the chapter being dissolved?
Well, I found out because it had been defunct for several years, and I grew up around the NAACP. And I couldn't imagine living in a community that didn't have a chapter. And so I started making some phone calls to some of the civic leaders who I knew would be very helpful in making this come about. And Wilbur Aldridge, who is the regional director for the Hudson Valley, I contacted him, and he said, you have to do X, Y, and Z. So I put together a little brainstorming session, I call it, and I got in touch with one of the local cafe restaurant owners downtown, and I said, I want to have a brainstorming meeting. I promise you 5 people max will show up. It was afternoon time during lunch in a small cafe that probably sat maybe 30 people. And I said, you know what? Half of the people I invited won't even show up. So 5 people if I'm lucky. I sent out an email blast to maybe 50, 75 people. And I didn't get that many responses, so I was for sure that if anything, it was going to be me and maybe my next-door neighbor who showed up. I start turning around, and as one person comes from that direction, one person comes from that direction. Lo and behold, we filled up the whole freaking cafe.
Wow.
And the owner of the cafe looked at me, and she gave me this look on her face. And I said, oh, my God, she is not happy with me. She eventually got over it, but it just showed you sometimes, that was a lesson too, when you send out an email blast, you better believe that half of the people who you think might not show up will end up coming. And you know, the whole term of RSVP, a lot of people, it doesn't work in their vocabulary. So even if you tell them the RSVP, they might just show up anyway. So I had an excellent opportunity to sit down with some of the really leaders civically in the community. And that brainstorming session turned into a series of consecutive monthly meetings with the NAACP that had upwards of 200 people at those meetings. And so it was really a collective effort from the community. Once we got to the point where we could start a chapter and we could revitalize it, they all looked around and said, who do we elect as the president? Who do we select? And everyone started to point their fingers at me. And the regional director said, oh, no, not so fast. You have to be 21 to be the president of an adult chapter. And it was just so ironic that I had sort of spearheaded the movement to create the group, and then once it was formed, I wasn't even old enough to lead it. And so it was that's sort of the irony sometimes when trying to do something in the community. But he did say, he said, you're the youngest person to have resurrected an adult chapter. Other people your age have done it for youth chapters. And that was confirmed by Julian Bond, who is the past chairman of the NAACP. So that was really a labor of love for the community. In Middletown, where I grew up, it's a very diverse community, and it needed an NAACP chapter. The same way that they needed diversity on the Board of Education with younger people and more minorities. And I believe in representation of representation. So I think the community should always be reflected in its elected bodies. And I think it's a shame for it to be any way about that.
That's excellent. Now, when you say, I know that you're really actively involved in it's two questions here that I want to ask. One is that you're actively involved in making sure that the African Americans are represented collectively in the various communities. And also you are very involved in the youth and making sure that their voice is heard. Now, how do you figure out what involvements you're going to partake in and what is something that you're just not going to touch on?
Well, it's funny you ask, because on May 1st, a group, Young Professionals and Politically Engaged, asked me if I would moderate a discussion with the Democratic candidate running for mayor of New York City. And I said, absolutely. And the reason I said I would do it is because they wanted the young people in the community to be intricately involved, not only in the planning of the event, but in asking some of the questions that are going to be posed to the candidates. And so on May 1st, 6 to 10 at the CUNY Graduate Center, May 1st, 6 to 10 p.m. at CUNY Graduate Center in New York City, that will be taking place. And Christine Quinn is the only one who's declined to attend. But I am very proud of this particular event, because young people just focus, but they're going to be involved in the planning of the event. And to your question, I only would participate in an event that was geared towards young people if they were actually involved in the planning and the production of it. Because a lot of times young people, especially in politics, we're told you can sit in the corner and you can lick all the envelopes in the world, and when you get tired of licking the envelopes, drink a bottle of water and then go back at it. And that is not how young people should be approached, especially with getting involved in civic activity. That's why a lot of young people are turned off, because young people can develop the courage and the intellectual prowess to learn how to phone bank and learn how to canvas and learn how to put those operations together and really take their ability as young people to encourage other young people to get involved. And with some of the technological advances that we have, young people are probably a little bit more, I'm saying young people are better than the older generation, but young people can be more in tap and in tune with some of the technological advances that will help smooth and streamline the process of campaigning. And to a broader extent, how we do everything in the world. There is always new ways of approaching things and new ways of seeing things. And sometimes young people can be very influential in helping older generations or wiser generations overcome some of the hurdles that they've encountered in every area and aspect of their lives and in their professions. So I always try to say to the wiser generation, look to young people not as people who are trying to prevent you from succeeding, but who are trying to aid you in succeeding. And I think some of the biggest misconceptions about young people is that once you give them enough access to information, they want to take it and run with it and become somewhat of a hindrance to, you know, wiser generations trying to succeed. And that's not the case. There are a lot of young people who want to learn, who want to be involved in the process, but they want you to respect them and utilize them for what they can bring to the table. So for me, it's a no-brainer for me. If you want me to help support an event, which I get asked to do, and I'm more than happy to do it, young people have to be a part of it from the ground up.
That makes a great deal of sense. And also, it gives them the opportunity to have experience, which is something that they need. They need the experience to be able to
absolutely to
discover and, you know, find out what it is that they want to do and what they like to do. If you never give an opportunity, you'll never know.
Absolutely. And to that extent, a lot of people always say to me on both ends, what do you tell young people and give them advice, and how, when young people come to you, what do you say to them? And I always say, I've moved away from the notion that young people need mentors. And I say young people need sponsors. In this economy and in this society, we have to transition ourselves from trying to get mentors who can advise us and instead get sponsors who are willing to pick up the phone and advocate for us. Because the wiser generations have a lot of connections, they know a lot of people, and they know the kind of dots that you have to connect in order for you to get to where you need to go. And so if you really want to be a journalist and you have a mentor, in quotes, who says you have to go and get an internship at Fox TV, then I think that young person needs to go to that quote-unquote mentor and say, I know you said I need an internship at Fox. Do you know someone who works at Fox who can help streamline the process of my internship application? Or do you know someone who knows someone who knows someone at Fox who can help streamline my application? And can you pick up the phone or email them on my behalf? And that turns that mentor into a sponsor, because if you're going to make it in this 21st century economy, you're going to have to be a social entrepreneur. I wholeheartedly believe that. But you're also going to need sponsors, people who are willing to not just recommend you or to suggest, but who can actually pick up the phone and say, Johnny right here has something special. You need to have him come in for an interview.
I agree with you on that one as well, because of the fact that the economy, the way it is, has become such a battleground just for the basic jobs, like working at McDonald's. And where do you go? And you really need someone to advocate for you in order for you to be able to at least get your foot in the door, because the doors are shut. They are really slammed shut nowadays, and there's not a lot that you can do if you know no one.
Right.
Now, the other question I wanted to ask you, in the media, we have young folks who are represented in such a negative light. How do you feel about that?
Young people represented in a negative light, you said?
Yes.
Well, that's something that, unfortunately, as a society, we have, as consumers, told the powers that be what we want to see. It's sort of like the reality TV movement. If no one was watching The Real Housewives of Atlanta, it wouldn't be on the air. If no one was watching Kim Kardashian and her family with the reality show, it wouldn't be on the air. As popular as Kim Kardashian and NeNe Leakes are, if no one was watching the show, it wouldn't be on the air, and there certainly wouldn't be sequels and other franchises sprouting out of that. And if no one was watching the fact that there are specials on negativity surrounding young people, so those specials would never exist. We have to get to a point as a society where we stop feeding into it, because the more we feed into it, the more the producers and the executives at these television networks are going to say, you know what, people may not like it, but they're watching it. They may not like it, but they're talking about it. So we need to start putting out positive images of ourselves and make it's our own personal missions to only support those stories and to promote those stories that are positive. And that's why it's so important what you're doing, Ms. Lyles, and having me on, because you could do an entire episode, 4 days. You could do a series of interviews and shows on the negativity that's out there just by what's being reported. But instead, you chose to highlight something that is deemed positive and something that is probably a little bit unconventional, because I tell you, I've approached producers at different shows, and I've had other people promote me to different producers. And sometimes when you're talking about positivity, people go, well, how does that bring in ratings? I know you're doing this and you're doing that, but what is that? How does that translate into more views? How does that translate into advertising dollars? And some people are just looking at the bottom line. And so I love the fact that you're trying to change the mold of what you're doing with this show and having me on, and that's what other people, we need people like you booking shows on national television. We need people like you producing news segments for the major networks, because when we have people who think like you, then they'll put on stories like myself and other young people trying to do things that are positive instead of highlighting the negative.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And, well, my whole thing is I spent a lot of time working with young folks, and I just find them just so delightful because of the fact that they bring light to situations, because oftentimes most people, as they get older, they tend to forget the things that they've experienced when they were younger. And when you continue to engage yourself with people who are younger than yourself, it keeps your mind sharp. And also you kind of like stay in touch with what's going on and really in touch with reality. And that's the part that I love about that. That's the part that I love about exposing young adults who are doing positive things to people that I know, and giving them the opportunity to see it's not just the person on the corner. It's different than that. So wake up and realize this is what it's about, not that. And it is my pleasure having you on the show.
Now, where are you located, can I ask?
Well, sure. Right, I am located in Delaware. However, I also do live shows in New York. And I'm
shows in New York?
Yes, and I'm originally from Brooklyn as well.
Ah, where in Brooklyn?
Prospect Heights.
Love it. I play tennis there.
Really? Okay. So my question to you is, we have a national security issue. The public safety of Americans we're at jeopardy. What are your thoughts on that? Because this whole Boston Marathon thing, I am a runner also, and I've participated in New York City Marathon and run some other races, and this whole thing has me shaken. What are your thoughts on our safety in general?
Yeah, well, you know, there are two different issues going on right now. First, there is the national security issue as it pertains to gun violence, and then there's the terrorist attacks, right? Because that's what it was reported to be in Boston, a terrorist attack. And, you know, on both fronts, I'm sort of like a President Jimmy Carter fanatic when I say things like, you know, can we have more peace? whoever said that, can't we all just get along? You know, I'm a big believer in just trying to handle things in a more dialogue type way and talk things out and try to, I'm very communicative that way. It's always been my nature. But I think on the terrorist front, the United States, many times as citizens, we let our guard down. And I say that because even when I am in New York City subway system, I hear noises, I turn around.
Mm-hmm.
I see people doing things. I flinch in a heartbeat, and I'm not in any way blaming citizens for terrorist activity, but I do think that as citizens, we have to be a little bit more vigilant in our walks. I see that, if a car makes a loud noise in the middle of the street, very few people turn around to see what that noise is. I'm turning around, and people are knocking me down as I'm trying to turn around to see what's going on. Because it's very, very important to be aware of your surroundings and what's going on around you. Now, nationally, we have to develop on a foreign policy front, much better relations. And this is why the Secretary of State is important and the United Nations is important, because all of this terrorist activity stems from something. It stems from the appearance, in some cases and in other cases reality, that the United States is not well-liked abroad. And that is something that our leaders have to, on the federal level, work to alleviate and dismantle. Because as we are the power force that we are, called the United States of America, we really have to be careful about how we treat other countries and nations and how they view and respect us in return. I won't go into a whole diatribe with you about the history with the United States and some countries who they have not been nice to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to be a little bit more mindful about what goes around does come around. And just because we're the United States, you know, we still have a peacemaking role to play in the world. And to the extent that we can do that successfully, I think you'll find a lot of these activities to cease. Now, that doesn't mean that people who are hateful are going to stop being hateful, because people who will get on planes and arm themselves with bombs to blow up other people are just hateful people. They're just incredibly spiteful, and that's innate. It's very difficult to eradicate that. But from a foreign policy initiative, we do have to play a bigger role in making sure that we treat other people in the way that we want to be treated.
I think that goes across the board in general, basically. Now, you've had the pleasure of interviewing some really amazing people. Can you tell me which interview that you did was the most engaging and enjoyable, and which one was one that had you a little starstruck?
Ooh, those are two very loaded questions. I like many of my interviews for very different reasons, and you know, I had the privilege of producing them myself. So the guests were because I wanted them and I liked them and appreciated them for some reason or the other. And the topics and the questions were all mine. So I had the privilege of not being beholden to a producer or some casting director who said, you have to interview so-and-so and these are the questions, so go. So for that very reason, I would say that every single interview in person that I came across, I liked for many different reasons. So I can sort of give you the highlights of some of the interviews. And maybe that will answer your question in a more diplomatic kind of way. One of them, Dr. Maya Angelou. I mean, she sort of course, she stood out because Dr. Maya Angelou, at that time I was doing New School Radio, which was for college, online radio. And Dr. Maya Angelou does not really do college radio shows. She's on national television all the time, and her time, of course, is very, very important. So if she takes her time away to be interviewed by little old me, that has to be a good interview. So one of the things that I did was I tried to find out something that a lot of people didn't know and try to retweak it or re-ask it in a different way. And one of the things that I found out is that during the time that she was mute, I know why the caged bird sings, she didn't talk, but she started singing. And singing was her way of sort of getting a bit more comfortable and familiar with her voice and finding her voice. And she toured the country as a singer. A lot of people don't know this. Dr. Maya Angelou was a professional singer and sang across the country. And so as I interviewed her, I said, I recall you singing a song at the funeral for Coretta Scott King. Do you mind singing a few of the lines to that song? And she stopped and she said, oh, thank you very much, Mr. Paul. And she started singing the song.
Wow.
Who can envision Dr. Maya Angelou singing the song? To them, nonetheless. And so that is a moment that I will always treasure. And that's something that I have on tape. It's recorded, and it will live forever. So no one can take that away. There are other interviews that stand out for other reasons. One of them, I was a big fan, and still am, I should say, of the TV show The Jeffersons. Who isn't, right?
That's right.
And, of course, there is George Jefferson, played by Sherman Helmsley, who I actually spoke to a couple of months before he died. I called him at his house in El Paso, Texas, and we were scheduled to do an interview shortly before he died. And that was very, very unfortunate because he was doing a project at the time and he couldn't do it. But he said, we're going to schedule it and we'll do it. He was so happy to do the interview. And, however, I was able to interview the maid, Marla Dibbs, who played Florence. And I just wanted the opportunity to open up my interview with that theme song, Moving On Up. And listening to her talk about her experiences, she's now in Los Angeles, California, and talking about how when she started in the industry, they had to literally fight to get African-American and minority actors and actresses on work, on whether it was television, screen, you name it, theater. There was a fight to get minorities to play parts. And that back then, they weren't doing it for the money, because there's very little money to be made, as opposed to now. And it was some of the passion and listening to her tell the story in a way that only someone like Marla Gibbs can. That really touched my heart, and it made an impact on me. And whenever I speak to people who are currently actors or actresses or who want to aspire to be, I always say, you have got to listen to the interview I did with Marla Gibbs, because that kind of passion and fire in your belly really does come from within. And it's not something that everyone has, but if you have it, that makes you special. Some of the other interviews stand out to me are ones with people like Kit Shapiro, who is the daughter of the legendary actress Eartha Kitt. And I grew up as a fan of Eartha Kitt, and many people call me an old soul. And who doesn't remember the iconic purr?
Yes.
And I spoke to her daughter. Her daughter was so excited about what I was trying to do that she came from Connecticut to her home. From her home, and came to New York to be with me in studio. That's how much she wanted to do the interview.
Wow.
And her mother, Eartha Kitt, named her daughter Kit Shapiro, so that when she was introducing them to, she would say, I'm Eartha and this is Kit, as if they completed each other. That's where her name came from. And those stories, I didn't know that Eartha Kitt was shy. Who would think that Eartha Kitt standing on stage doing Santa Baby and all the sounds and purrs was a shy woman? But her daughter tells me, who was her manager many years before her death, that Eartha Kitt would always grab onto her and say, are they going to like me? Will anyone show up? Especially towards the later part of her life, because she was such a shy woman. I had no idea.
Wow.
There are other interviews that said I can go on for days about the interviews because, again, these are all people that, for some reason or another, I asked to interview and I sought them out because these were people that I personally wanted to interview. Do you remember the Olympics years ago? There were the three black men who had the Black Power salute.
Yes, yes.
Dr. Juan Carlos is one of those people, John Carlos, excuse me. And I interviewed John Carlos about his experiences with the salute and how that came about. That one never made it to air, unfortunately, but I still have it on tape. I can prove I did it, and he can tell you I did it. he's from Harlem, and a delightful, delightful man. And one of the things that was so touching is I really wanted to get the human side of him, because a lot of people talked about the story, but they really get the human side. I was reading all this stuff, and I said, well, I wonder what he thinks about this now. And after the interview with him, he said, young man, I just want to tell you that this is one of the more thought-provoking interviews I've ever done. And it really did touch me. And you brought out things in me that I even forgot and didn't talk about in other interviews. So thank you very much. And that really touched me, especially as an interview. You never want to get validation, but when you get it, you take it. You know, you won't tell someone, don't tell you a nice thing. Susan failed to, and again, tell me to stop whenever you want to. I can go on forever.
No,
Susan
I'm listening. I'm enjoying.
Susan Fales Hill, who was an author and writer. She was a writer for shows like The Cosby Show and A Different World. She is the daughter of Josephine Primese, who is a famous actress. She talked about a lot of different things, growing up in a mixed family and trying to raise her daughter in a world that accepted and appreciated her, and trying to instill values in all different types of people who otherwise wouldn't know that they had value and self-worth, because the society that we're in doesn't always tell people that they're valuable and they are brilliant and beautiful. You have a lot of images out there that make people second guess their beauty and their self-worth. So she's a writer that's all about positivity and karma and good judgment and value. So I appreciated her. And she's also very funny. She's very comedic and has a sense of humor. And I always appreciate people with a sense of humor. Do you remember the group LaBelle, with Patti LaBelle, Nona Hendricks, and Sarah Dash?
Yes.
I interviewed Sarah Dash. I went to Trenton, New Jersey, where she lives now, and did an extensive interview with her and talked about how they came up with hits like Lady Marmalade and What Can I Do For You and their touring history and some of the behind-the-scenes stuff that went on that a lot of people didn't really know about. Sarah Dash and I have stayed in touch since then. We email, I would say, at least every week or two. She had a one-woman show in the city. She's invited me to it. My birthday came up, and she said, why don't you bring some of you or friends to come see the show? And I thought she was joking. I really did. But then I submitted names to her, and her assistant was very accommodating. And me and my 10-15 friends really did go in there. We were dancing up a storm to Lady Marmalade and all the other songs. So hospitable, and she said to me, I want you to call me Aunt Sarah. So she is. She's my Aunt Sarah now. Is still doing her thing and has a couple of shows coming up in May, one around Mother's Day, so you guys should check that out. But she is just a positive light force and someone who always believes in encouraging and instilling other people. So that was another interview that I really enjoyed. And many of the interviews that I've had have come out with relationships and friendships that I still have to this day. Many of the people I just talked to you about are my friends, not only on Facebook, but we communicate on email, telephone, and they've stayed in touch with the progress that I've made since interviewing them and have worked with some of them on other projects after that. It's something that really goes around in several different dimensions. If you're nice to people and if you treat people with respect and dignity, they will never forget that. And then at some point, they will have an opportunity to say to you, now I see what you've done, now you should do this, and they will help you along your career path. There are other interviews. I can go on and on. Oh, I've interviewed people like the great-great-granddaughter of Madam C.J. Walker, Aaliyah Bundles, who's one of those people, too, who has championed history and trying to expose younger people to history and the importance of knowing their history as African Americans. Cheryl Wills, who's a New York One anchor in New York, who has been extremely helpful to anyone who would ask her for advice and career suggestions. The great grandson of Ida B. Wells, who was probably one of the first prominent African American journalists in this country that covered lynching back when no one wanted to even give her a pen to write on. And there are other interviews. Oh, gosh, you're tracking my memory now. Who else did I interview? I can go on and on and on for days, really, because they were all so very, very important. And, you know, someone always said to me, this is a different take. Who would you have liked to interview? Well, I'm so happy you asked that question, Ms. Lyles, because the entire time that I was trying to put these interviews together, there was one person that I was trying to get who I just could not get. And that is Diane Carroll, the actress, singer, performer.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to her assistant. We were trying to set up dates, and then something would happen where she would be on assignment. She lives in Los Angeles. I was trying to get her in person when she would get to New York. It was just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and we never got a chance to do the interview with Diane Carroll. And that was one that really, really bothered me because I really wanted to have her a part of my repertoire, if you will. I have such respect and admiration for the career that she has lived and the life that she's lived and things that she's tried to do, and not just for herself but for other people within the industry. And she just has such grace and poise and stamina. And all of that adds up to really legendary status. That's people you really call legends. in their own right. Other interviews like Lilly Ledbetter, the Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, who went up against Goodyear Tire and, although didn't win, became a lightning rod for what it means to have pay equity in our country. Still living in Alabama with that southern drawl, and is just as nice as can be. And her fight and her tenacity to win and to succeed, even when you think that you've lost, you've won. Major lesson, and lessons like that come from people who live them. I respect lessons that come from people who have lived them. Instead of someone saying, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it, I want someone who's been through some trek, been through the fire and the rain, tell me that I can make it. And she's one of those people, really like better. Oh, heavens, who else?
Yeah.
How much time do you have?
Don't worry about it. We're good. We're good. I wanted to know, what do you, you have a birthday coming up. Okay, so what are you going to do for your birthday, Juan? And where do you see yourself going?
You know, it's so funny you ask me that, because someone else just, a friend of mine the other day said, what are you going to do for your birthday? And would you believe, I've never thrown a party.
Really?
I've never had an event surrounded by me, because for some reason, I don't think that a lot of people respond personally very well to personal invites. And that's probably because I've never done it. But for me, I always find that my time and my energy is much better spent when it's focused around either other people or cause. And so for the past couple of years, I've surrounded my birthday with a charity. And in 2011, it was the AIDS, 2012 rather, it was the AIDS Walk. And I said, you know, instead of giving me a birthday gift or something, give it to the AIDS Walk. And I always found that whenever I did that, people who normally wouldn't give me a gift would donate to the charity. And so I said, fine. There are people who wouldn't give me a gift anyway. So if they feel more compelled and obliged to give a donation to charity, then heck, let the charity benefit from the, you know, my birthday, if you will. Because the truth is, I have most of what I need. I mean, there are certain things that I want. But in terms of my basic expenses and my necessities, I have everything that I need. And so if I can encourage and compel other people to give $5, $10, $15, $20 to an organization that actually needs it so that people can survive and get off the streets and live a basic life that a lot of us take for granted, then I'm happy to do that. Because if some, and I'm not ungrateful, but if someone gave me a pair of socks for my birthday, chances are I've been walking around with socks. I don't really need more socks. If someone said, hey, Roy, it's your birthday, here is a bottle of cologne, chances are I've got a lot of cologne. In fact, if you looked in my cabinet, you'll find about 4 or 5 bottles of cologne. I can do without the cologne, and I would much rather you take the 20, 50, 60 bucks that you paid on the cologne and give it to a charity that needs it. So, yeah, if someone gave me a BMW, I'll take it. You know, if someone said, I'll pay off half of your college tuition, I'll take it. But if it's a bottle of cologne or a pair of socks or a gift card for $50 to Marshalls or something, I'd rather you take that money and instead give it to a charity that could actually use it. So for my birthday, I'll probably end up doing that again this year. I haven't chosen a charity, and I've got literally a month from today to my birthday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe 2 weeks before that, I will start to try to promote some charity that I want people to give to. And, you know, the first time I did it, we raised a few $1,000. So, I always find that whenever I do something like that, people who normally wouldn't give me a gift, especially my extended social media family, more people are compelled to give when it's an event. So I probably won't do anything centered around me. Okay. Career-wise, I hope to stay involved in the media sphere in some way or the other. some people, you know, some people say, well, what do you want to do specifically? And I'm one of those believers where, of course, you have your end goal and something that you would really love to do if you have the opportunity. But I am trying to keep it very, very basic as of right now. I want to stay alive. I want to live a healthy life. I want to be surrounded by positive people. And I want to keep doing what I'm doing in the media sphere, commentating, being a speaker and an analyst. And, you know, whatever is meant to happen, it will happen. I'm a big believer in that. So, I'm trying not to force things or wrangle people in certain ways. If my career is destined to do X, Y, or Z, it will happen. And it will happen because I believe I did the best that I could to give back and to do the kind of things that are positive in nature. And that, I think, is the key to living and being successful. Do what you love, and then eventually the money, the success, or whatever it is that you deem to be success will eventually come. But I have a lot of friends who are in finance, and they don't have a life. They have to have coffee, meet up with people at 11 o'clock at night because that's the time they get out of work, and they're miserable. You talk to them and they say, I really don't love my job, but I love the money. And what's good about having money if you really don't have the time to enjoy it? You know, and there are people who love finance, and that's great. And you love finance, and you love the money, and that's wonderful. But if you don't love the money, and you just love the fact that you have a job that pays you enough money to live in a doorman building, then at the end of the day, what value is that going to bring to you when the only time you get to stay in that apartment is on the weekend?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm all about trying to do things that really add value and bring positive energy to people's lives. And if you really want to be a social worker and you really want to go to master's school to get that social work degree, if that's what's required, then don't worry about the tens of thousands of dollars in loans that you're going to get if you go to the school of your choice. Now, if you went to a school that you couldn't afford just because you wanted to get that school, that degree from that school, then that's on you. But if you want to go to a public college of any sort and get that degree, and you want to be a social worker, then be the best doggone social worker you can be, and the $35,000, $40,000 salary won't mean anything to you because you really love the work. And so, you know, I'm not saying go and get a low-paying job and, you know, and go and stack up colleges, debt. But you have to put it into perspective. Can you afford to go to graduate school? Do you really need a graduate degree? Are there other alternatives and pathways to getting into the career of your choice? And you have to analyze all of those things. And that's where sometimes having a sponsor helps. A sponsor can sit down and say, look at you. You don't need to go and get a master's degree. You need to do X, Y, and Z. You have to prove yourself in the field. You have to start your own business. You have to do X, Y, and Z. And if you need help, I can pick up the phone because I know someone who either can help you or know someone who might be able to help you. And that's what most people need today. They need to be given the right advice, and once they've gotten their hands on a good piece of information, they need someone who'll help connect the dots for them. I hope I answered your question.
You sure did. You definitely answered my question. Now, if people wanted to see you, other than May 1st, the event at the CUNY Grad Center, where else can people find you?
Excellent question, because I am now on social media in a lot of different ways. I'm on Facebook. I have a personal page that's really more of a public page, a professional page, where you have to add me to be my friend. And I hope after this interview, Ms. Lyles, you become my Facebook friend.
Yes, indeed.
I have a fan page, and I use that term loosely because I don't think I have fans. I have a lot of supporters. So I have a supporter page. That's what I call it. And you have to like it so you can like me on it. And I put a lot of more of my political thoughts on there as opposed to more of my personal things. I've tried to separate it as much as I could. I have a Twitter page, and I love to get followers, and I love people to tweet me and all that other stuff. All of that is connected to my cell phone. With the BlackBerry that I have, I'm still in tune technologically. Although I think I'm going to be upgrading it to an Android of some sort, of maybe. I probably won't get an iPhone because I'm just against the whole iPhone movement, really.
The Apple? You don't want to bite the apple? You don't want to bite the apple?
I don't want to bite the apple. That should be a Facebook status. I don't want to bite the apple. the MacBook Pro and iPad and all this. I had an iPad years ago. Can I tell you a story? I had an iPad, and I didn't use it because I thought that I would use it when I traveled. But I found that when I traveled, I was on my cell phone, and I didn't use my iPad. So I sat down, and I looked at this thing sitting on the corner, and I said, look, I'm not using this thing, but I spent so much money on it. So I ended up selling it and got the money and ended up doing other things with it. But I just couldn't justify it. And so I can't justify the hundreds and hundreds of dollars on iPhone when I can spend maybe a fraction of that on an Android that does the same thing. Or instead of getting a MacBook Pro, which for me, I'm pretty simple. I use the internet. I go on Facebook. If anything, I'm using some program in Microsoft Office. But I don't need a MacBook Pro. I'm not editing videos and doing some of the fancier gaming software. So a MacBook Pro, to me, is the exact same in terms of capability that a regular laptop that may cost $400 or $500. I don't need to spend $1,200, $2,000 on a laptop. I won't use it in the way that someone who really needs a MacBook Pro would use it. I have an HP laptop, and it's silver. If I close it, it looks like a MacBook Pro. Until I open it, you realize it's not. But it's an updated laptop. It works fine, and it does everything that I need it to do. Who cares if it's not a MacBook Pro? I saved $1,500. So for me, I've steered away from your question somehow on my rant, but you can connect with me on social media, of course, Facebook, Twitter, and then on my website. I don't know how it happened, but if you go to Google and you type my name in, Roy Paul, my website is one of the first three things that pop up. It's literally 1, 2, and 3. You can verify this if you don't believe me.
No,
I don't know how it happened. However that happened, I'm very thankful to the SEO powers that be for that. And my website, roy-paul.com. I don't update it in terms of current projects, but I definitely update it after the fact. I use it more as a depository to put all of the stuff that I've done in some way or another. Now, I can't put everything, but if I moderate a panel or if I do an interview like when I finish this interview with you, I will somehow try to transcribe it, put it on YouTube, and put links on my site so that people can, at a later time, go to it and listen to this interview.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's great. So where will you be speaking other than, live, other than May 1st?
So far, that is all I have on my schedule. I know that I'm doing a lot of promotion for the May 1st event. So I have a radio interview tomorrow, and then I have a couple of television appearances coming up towards the end of the month, and that I advertise on my social media. That's the best way to find out what's coming up with me, because I'll always put something like, on Sunday you can tune into ABC and watch me do so-and-so, and after I do the interviews, of course, I put up pictures and things like that. I'm a heavy promoter on Facebook, and I'm trying to come up with a social media policy for me, because I would say 90% of my operations are in-house. In terms of the bookings that I do and the social media promotions and sort of overall brand management, if you will, is done in-house, meaning I do that myself. I have some experience in PR, but I have a greater deal of experience in marketing and business development. And that's where sort of my expertise has come in line with how I branded myself. I have a publicist that assists me with some of the more technical aspects and the pitching that needs to be done. I work with Mary Moore, who was the connector in this case.
Yeah.
Other than that, the vast amount of activities that I do is really either because of some connection that I've had, or it's because I've seen on Facebook that there's a youth expo coming up in June hosted by State Senator so-and-so. And I will just call the State Senator's office, send them my information, and say, who's the person putting this together? Can I be a speaker? Can I be a moderator or something? And sometimes they say yes, sometimes they say no. But that really is, that comes most of the time that comes out of my initiating it. And other than that, it's really luck. Someone the other day emailed me and said, can I interview you for the story that I'm writing? I said, how the heck did you find me? She goes, I was Googling political commentators, experts, et cetera, and I came across your website. Who would have thunk?
All right. Well, I would love to continue. However, our time is almost up. However, I would love to have you. It's whatever I want it to be.
So I stayed on the phone for an entire hour. I can't believe it.
Yes. You were enjoying yourself,
my
weren't you?
My big mouth.
Weren't you enjoying yourself?
I is. My big mouth. I just got carried away there. I'm so sorry. All of your listeners.
No. Do not apologize. I am enjoying it, and I'm sure my listeners are enjoying it because of the fact that you just have so much energy in life, and I like listening to these stories, and I am so appreciative of the fact that you've taken the time out to be with us.
Yes, and at some point, whether it's in Delaware, New York, or wherever you are in the universe, you have to promise that we'll get together, either when you come to New York or if I find myself in Delaware, but you'll be adding me on Facebook, so we'll be able to stay in touch.
That's correct. And we do a show called, I do a segment where I produce called You, the Best Invention Ever. And that's the one that I do live. So the next time we have a live show, I'm going to contact you and perhaps you can come join us on the panel.
Oh, I would love to.
Oh, great. I think the ladies would love to have you.
and especially, I was going to say, I said, I'm going to get in trouble. I said, especially if they're single, but I don't want to get in trouble.
Well, there's a possibility.
I promise you, I'm very professional.
Oh, I know you will be, but they may not be. Okay,
awesome.
So it was a pleasure, and we will definitely stay in touch. You are my you're my new friend. Okay.
Yes, I'll be waiting for your Facebook request.
You got it. You got it. You have a wonderful evening, and thank you so much for joining us.
You too. Thank you.
Bye. Okay. Bye. Well, everyone, that was amazing, Roy Paul. He has been such a joy and a pleasure to have. He shared his perspectives on many different areas, and he let us see that the youth of today are really moving forward and offering us the opportunity to see that there is a chance for a better us, a better tomorrow. And with him at the helm of some of the things that he's doing and is going to do, I know things are going to be all right, and I'm not concerned at all. It was a pleasure. And please join us on, I believe, Saturday, where we'll have you, the best invention ever. And that's going to be kind of interesting. So she never really tells me who she has until the last minute. So I'll send out my email blast to let you know what's going down. Until then, have an amazing evening and be well.
That's our show for today. So until next time, keep it real, listen, learn, and live.